Okay, engine stop. APA at a descent.
It was July 20th, 1969, when Apollo 11 landed on the moon.
Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
I remember this, Molly, because July 20th happens to be my birthday, and I was having a party, or at least trying to.
Well, that's right, Seth. 50, age 50 is a milestone, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it wasn't my 50th, Molly, but thank you anyhow. No, there I was. There were about 30 people milling around my apartment. Plenty of snacks and drinks, but the party was still a dud.
Why's that?
Well, because they had turned the TV on.
Okay, Houston, I'm on the porch.
And there was Neil Armstrong making a big step for a hominid.
I'm going to step off the limb now. It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
I mean, I was walking around trying to get people to socialize. But everyone was crowded around my black and white television, which wasn't very big to begin with. And so there was this big knot of people in one corner of the living room.
Surface is fine and battery. I can pick it up loosely with my toe.
So it sounds like your party was hijacked by history.
Yeah, it's one of those moments that you can still picture, even 40 years later. I remember that the TV images were jerky, there was a slow frame rate, but it didn't matter. It was just exciting to see those guys stumbling across a world that had been dead and alone for 4 billion years.
I'd like to take this opportunity to ask every person listening in, whoever, wherever they may be, to pause for a moment and contemplate the events of the past few hours and to give thanks in his or her own way.
It's hard to believe that 40 years ago we hurled 2,000 tons of metal a quarter of a million miles to a pockmarked rock. We all thought this was the beginning of the conquest of space, the first step in the expansion of our presence beyond Earth, just as President Kennedy had urged us to do in 1961.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal before this decade is out of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
I'm Seth Shostak.
I'm Molly Bentley. Welcome to Are We Alone and Bodies in Motion, part of our astronomy series in celebration of the International Year of Astronomy.
Four, 3, 2, 1, 0. All engine running. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
You know, Molly, that was the fastest that humans have ever moved. Those astronauts were zipping through space at 26,000 miles per hour.
Wow, that's incredible. Can you feel that? I mean, I suppose when the rocket takes off, you can feel the shake. But when you're moving at 26,000 miles an hour, what does that feel like?
Well, strangely enough, you couldn't tell unless you looked out the window and saw the Earth shrinking behind you. You know, this was one of the great insights that Isaac Newton had 4 centuries ago, that as far as physics is concerned, moving in a straight line at a constant speed is really no different than not moving at all.
What do you mean by that?
Well, suppose you're in a car cruising down the highway. Wait a minute. Well, why don't we just do it? You want to go for a ride? Come on.
Okay.
Okay, why don't you get in here?
Oh, other side.
Okay. Yeah. You might want to put on your seatbelt.
All right. So this is going to teach me something about laws of motion?
Well, it's, yes. And even if it doesn't, at least I'll see some of the scenery here. Okay, Molly, we're cruising down the highway at 40 miles an hour. How can you tell? How can you tell we're cruising?
Well, I can see the landscape. The trees are going by the window. I can feel the car moving. I can feel some of the air.
Yeah, but except for this bumpy road and this cheap car, you wouldn't feel anything. I mean, suppose there were no shake, no tire noise. Say that I was driving in a glide-o-mobile.
Okay, a glide-o-mobile. But I would still see the trees going by, at least.
Yeah, but how do you know that the car isn't stopped and the trees are on wheels?
So the question is, I have to determine how I know whether it's the trees that are moving or the car that's moving?
Exactly. You see, there was an experiment about 110 years ago that proved that there's no way you can tell. I mean, if I put you in a box without windows in space, and that box, with you inside, is sailing along at 1,000,000 miles an hour away from the Earth, there's no way to tell that you're moving at all.
Why can't you tell that you're moving, and why is that important in physics?
Well, it boils down to this. Look, there's nothing in the universe that you can point to and say, this is the reference for all motion. This is not moving. This is absolutely stopped. All you can say is, I'm moving so many miles an hour relative to something else. There's no such thing as absolute motion. And this is the fundamental idea of relativity, you know? Einstein's theory of relativity, all motion is relative.
So when the astronauts were cruising to the moon, their speed was relative to what?
Well, we measured it relative to the Earth and to the moon, of course.
And so when they were doing that, they didn't feel like they were moving when they were in the rocket?
That's right. When they were in cruise mode, which was most of the trip, they couldn't tell they were moving.
How much faster were they going than this car?
About 5,000 times faster.
Can this car go that fast, 26,000 miles an hour?
Well, of course it can, Molly. I'll just shift here into hyperdrive.
That was fun. But why were we able to feel that, Seth?
Well, that's because we were changing our speed. That's acceleration or deceleration. So that results in a force. That you can measure, absolutely, just not uniform motion.
And so there are plans for astronauts to once again make that lunar cruise and feel that motion again or not feel that motion again, whatever applies?
That's right. NASA has plans to put humans on the moon by 2020. That's part of the Moon, Mars, and Beyond initiative.
And one of the first steps is to launch the NASA Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. And I spoke with the deputy project scientist, John Keller.
And he said this time the trip to the moon isn't motivated so much by political considerations to beat the Russians, so much as by science.
Okay, well, maybe we should head back to the studio.
Sounds like a good idea. I wonder if my parking space is still there.
From a scientific point of view, it's extremely important for understanding the history of the formation of the Earth-Moon system. The moon, because it doesn't have an atmosphere, has a record of what happened on the Earth in terms of impacts on the Earth. Well, those things occurred on the moon, and so there's essentially a record of, on geological time scales, of the history of the development of the Earth and the moon.
Well, indeed, the moon was created from the Earth, wasn't it, and because of a large impact?
That's right. So the clock starts at the same time for both systems. You had the large impact, which is, I think, pretty much established as the leading theory for how the Earth-Moon system was created. There was a large impact by a Mars-sized planet or asteroid, and it hit what people will call the proto-Earth. And it was such a large impact that debris and vaporization took place, and then the systems reformed. The geological clock for both of them starts then.
One of the questions I think people have is that if it's important to return to the moon, why we haven't done so in 40 years?
Well, first of all, after the Apollo missions ended, NASA diverge in two directions. We went with the shuttle and the space station for the astronaut program, but our science began to look out to other planets. And we ended up focusing on Mars, fairly aggressive observational program of studying Mars. And then, of course, we sent probes to Saturn. And so we managed to essentially develop a lot more knowledge of these other planets, Saturn, Jupiter, Mars. And I think over time, in some respects, we know more about Mars than we do about the moon. Not in all respects, because we have the samples from the Apollo mission. But for Mars, we have a better map of the Martian surface. And so one of the objectives of the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter mission is to give us better maps of the moon, especially in those areas that weren't very well studied during the Apollo missions. The Apollo missions were focused on the equatorial regions, and LRO is going to be focused more on the polar regions. It's really a global measurement, but it's in the polar regions of the moon that we're lacking information in the maps.
Now, you mentioned LRO, and that's the acronym for the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and this is your project. And this is going to answer one of the big questions when you return to the moon is where you land. So the idea is that this orbiter will give you some information about possible landing sites, although we know that we do want to land at the poles and that the LRO will tell us more about exactly where to land.
The thought here is that for the equatorial regions, if there's going to be an extended stay, you're faced with the 14-day lunar nights and 14-day daytimes because of the rotation of the moon. The moon's face is always facing the Earth, and so a lunar day is essentially a month long, the time it takes for the moon to rotate around the Earth. And that means with those long nights, you don't have access to solar power. But if you went to the poles, there may be areas which are either continuously illuminated or illuminated most of the time. And the reason for that is simply that the moon's spin axis is only slightly tilted with respect to the ecliptic plane or the sun. And so because it's only slightly tilted, if you're standing on the pole, the sun will look like it's on the horizon 1.5 degrees above the horizon or 1.5 degrees below the horizon.
So the idea is you always have a little bit of sunlight, and this is important not so that we can see what we're doing, but because we have the sun's rays to fuel the solar panels.
Yes, and then also you expect that the temperature there in the poles, it may not be ideal, but at least you won't have the wide swings that you would in the equatorial regions.
Well, John, tell me a little bit about how the LRO, the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, determines a safe and a suitable landing site.
Well, it has 7 instruments, and those instruments are focused not only on the objective of safe landing sites, but also possible resources, and there's an instrument for radiation safety. In the case of the safe landing sites, we have on there a laser altimeter, and that instrument essentially measures the topography of the lunar surface, and it fires a laser beam from the orbiter down to the surface and looks at the reflected light that comes back. By timing that whole process using the speed of light, you get essentially the distance from the spacecraft to the surface. And then over time, you're able to build up essentially what looks like the topography of the surface. You can see the craters, how deep they are, etc. A second instrument is a set of cameras, and on LRO, we have essentially 2 kinds of cameras. We have a very high-resolution camera, and it has a resolution, a pixel resolution of 0.5 meters. And that is sufficient to look for large boulder fields, etc. We'd be able to observe those and identify those regions, some places that maybe we wouldn't want to land.
What is the ideal landing site? What does it look like?
Well, I think the ideal landing site is one that's fairly flat, essentially. That's what it boils down to, that you want something that's flat. In Apollo, I think it was Apollo 15, it landed with 1 foot in a very small crater, so that if you look at images of Apollo 15, you can actually see that it's tilted over somewhat. And, you know, that was probably pretty exciting for the astronauts at that time, but maybe it's not something we want to do again.
Now, the Apollo missions were designed for exploration and also some science, but the return to the moon this time around is more ambitious in the science goals, but also for this plan to stay long-term. Is the idea that humans would live off the lunar land at some point?
The possibility of using resources on the moon is something I think that's well into the future and fairly speculative at this point, but it's something that we can start thinking about, certainly. LRO is going to be looking for resources. That's one of its goals.
Can you define resources?
Yeah, resources are something that we could use when we're there. So the first resource that we can use right away is solar power. And that's, you know, again, what we discussed about looking for places on the moon near the poles that might be elevated enough so that even in the so-called lunar winter, you still have access to solar power. So that's something that, you know, we're very interested in. But we're also interested in the possibility that there may be water mixed in with the regolith in permanently shadowed craters.
We should say regolith is the material that makes up the surface of the moon.
That's right. This is a sort of a material. It's been essentially gardened in over billions of years by meteoritic impacts, and so it's not solid rock. We know that there are craters at the poles which are permanently shadowed. They don't have direct access to sunlight at any time. And therefore, they're cold traps. They're very cold, and it's possible there's water mixed in with this regolith. And so that's one of the things that LRO will be looking for.
Now, finally, I believe it's still NASA's plan to have astronauts back on the moon by 2020.
Uh-huh.
But, of course, there's a lot that needs to be done before then. The launch of the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter is coming up quite soon, isn't it?
Yes, June 17th is our launch day.
How long does it take to get to the moon?
It'll take 4 or 5 days. So we're taking a path that's very similar to the Apollo mission.
And if people want to follow the launch, where should they go? Besides going down, is it being launched from Cape Canaveral?
It's being launched from Cape Canaveral. I believe it will be on NASA TV. And, of course, we have a website, www.nasa.gov/LRO.
Okay, for those of you who can't get down to Florida and can't get down to Cape Canaveral, you can watch it all on the web. Well, John, thank you very much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
John Keller is the Deputy Project Scientist for NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. Coming up, tips for getting around the universe. It's Bodies in Motion on Are We Alone? Science Radio for a thinking species on any world. We've been hearing about NASA's program to send humans back to the moon and beyond.
Would you want to go to the moon, Seth?
Well, yeah, Molly. It was my childhood dream to be an astronaut.
Is that true?
Yeah. I had a ticket to be on the first rocket to the moon from the Hayden Planetarium in New York when I was 10 years old.
Well, you didn't go, so what happened?
Well, it turned out that was a publicity stunt, that ticket. But I didn't realize that until I was, 21 or something like that. Anyhow, when I was a kid, anticipating this trip, there was one thing that really scared me.
Besides getting in a rocket and going to the moon?
Well, yeah, it was the training, the astronaut training. I thought I'd get sick in those centrifuges, the machines that spin you around.
So you didn't like roller coasters when you were a kid?
Well, roller coasters were okay, but anything that spun, that made me sick.
Well, that makes that trip that we took to MIT's Manned Vehicle Lab all the more remarkable, because I didn't realize we were conquering a childhood fear of yours when I volunteered you, and not me, for the centrifuge.
Yeah, well, I thought that you were actually trying to play on my fears.
Yeah, now, but you told us earlier that you can't actually feel any motion when you're moving at a constant speed, so wouldn't that apply to a centrifuge as well?
Well, no, it's true. You wouldn't feel motion if you were moving in a straight line. But, of course, the centrifuge is going round and round, and it's changing direction all the time. So that change in motion, that change in direction, causes forces on you. Think about it. When you're in a car, it goes around a corner, well, you get thrown one side or the other. That's due to the change in velocity.
I see, because you're going in a different direction now.
Right.
But this MIT centrifuge is being used to simulate the force of gravity. So how do you get that by changing direction? What's the connection between gravity and changing your motion?
Well, I know that's a little confusing, but it's not only confusing to you, Molly. It was also confusing to Einstein.
Okay, that gives me comfort.
Yeah, well, he wondered why the forces caused by a change in velocity behave just like gravity. I mean, why should they be the same?
But Seth, gravitational attraction is present whenever you have two objects, for example, this cup here on this desk. So how is that force different from the force that's created when an object is spinning?
Well, indeed, you can't tell the difference unless you happen to know that one's being caused by gravity or another is being caused by change of motion. And Einstein realized there was something profoundly important about that, and that led him to develop his general theory of relativity that says that masses just warp space and we interpret that as gravity.
Well, all of this is being put into practice at MIT with the help of Jaime Mateus so that we'll be able to simulate gravity for the astronauts on long space flights, for example, to Mars. And of course, this gives Seth a chance to confront his childhood fear.
Hi, Jaime. Hey, nice digs you've got down here.
Hi, Seth. Welcome. Yeah, this is our human centrifuge, which is pretty useful if we're thinking of any long-duration missions, such as going to Mars, for example.
So you're really getting ready for a future trip to Mars here.
Yeah, we know that any time we spend a long amount of time in outer space, we need to take care of our body so that it doesn't decondition. And one of the ways we can do that is by using our artificial gravity centrifuge, which helps us exercise in a simulated gravity environment and keeps us healthy throughout the whole journey.
So if you were in a spacecraft that didn't have any gravity of its own, I mean, somehow in the movies and on TV shows, those spacecraft always have, normal gravity. But if they didn't have it, then you could just, sit in this thing for a while and it would be the same as living all day under 1G.
Well, you could do two things. One is you could spin the entire spacecraft, and then it's like you had an enormous centrifuge. The whole spacecraft would be spinning. That's one option, except it's obviously a bit more expensive, a bit more complicated in terms of the engineering that's required. The other option is we have a small centrifuge like the one we have here, which is pretty much sized for a single human at a time. And what we can do is we can have the human exercise while they're spinning around in this short radius centrifuge, and that provides significant health benefits that can help maintain their condition throughout the entire journey.
Well, Jaime, this looks like some sort of high-tech update of a medieval torture device. You got kind of a horizontal sled here. It's sort of an aluminum bed for one, and it's pivoted there. It's sitting on a post and looks like it kind of rotates around. That's got me a little bit scared. It's got all sorts of equipment tied to it as well. This is a pretty interesting device. I suppose it would just fit in a one-car garage.
That's a pretty accurate description of it. I mean, it's essentially a bed that rotates around in one plane, the horizontal plane. And the people who ride it, they'll lay down as if they're lying down on the bed. The center of rotation is pretty much where their head is. So that means as we start spinning you up, you're going to feel your feet are being pushed towards the footplate. So essentially, you feel like you're standing on the footplate even though you're lying down on the bed.
So this is designed for an environment where there might not be any gravity, but you're going to kind of imitate gravity by spinning me?
Well, it doesn't create the force of gravity. It creates centripetal acceleration, which essentially just means that, you know, imagine if you're spinning a ball attached to a string and you're spinning it around. Well, you're lying on, if you were lying on that string, you would feel as if you're pushed towards the end of the string, which is essentially what we have here, except that instead of a string, we have a bed. And as we spin people up, they feel as if they're being pushed towards the end of the bed. So this gravitational environment is analogous to what you feel under Earth's gravity.
But why would you have to do this in space? I mean, everybody complains about gravity, particularly as they get older. They don't seem to think that gravity is a good thing for them. Why is it that we need gravity? Why does my body need all this gravity anyhow?
As we go into space, there's a series of negative effects on the body. So you accumulate bone mineral density loss, which essentially means that your bones become weaker. That's coupled with muscle atrophy because a lot of muscles that you use when you're walking around in day-to-day life, you don't have to use when you're in space. So not using those muscles for a long period of time causes them to atrophy and weaken significantly. So Seth, I'm actually working on a few things on the centrifuge right now, and I need a volunteer to help me testing it. Would you mind jumping in for a few minutes?
All right, I hope I'm dressed for this. All right, well then I guess I just get into this bed here. How do I do this, Jaime? I mean,
pretty much just get on as if you're just lying down on the bed.
All right, well I'll just try and climb into this. It's going to require a little bit of agility and dexterity and, you know, like that, which probably don't have any of anyhow. All right, well I guess I'll just try and get on board here.
You can grab on here and here, just not on the top.
Got it. Okay, here we go. Oh, this is like getting into a small sports car. Except I hope it doesn't go as fast as a small sports car.
So you can get your head in the helmet here, and don't worry about
that. Why the helmet? Is this a crash helmet? Okay, I'm lying down here, and I'm trying to fit my head in this helmet. And it feels really comfortable now. So far, so good. But then again, it's not spinning yet either.
I'll strap you up, make sure you don't go anywhere. this is the emergency stop button. So if you press this button, what it does is it cuts the power to the centrifuge. It won't stop immediately. It'll just gradually come to a stop. But we won't get to that stage. I'll be here. Any problems you have, just let me know.
You just throw your body against this thing as it's rotating.
So you push down on the footplate.
Okay, push down on the footplate. My feet are fully extended. I'm lying completely horizontally. Now, I'm always willing to take a new vehicle for a spin, but this may go too far. Okay, all the lights are going out. That is to say, in the room, hopefully not in my brain. Jaime has gone over and flipped a few switches. This can't be good.
Okay, you ready to start?
I guess I'm ready to go here. So
start very slowly.
Spin her up.
Spin you up, okay?
Okay. Well, the whole world seems to be turning here. I'm spinning. I can feel my legs pulling apart down there. I mean, they're pulling out from my body toward my toes.
Spinning.
I think I'm okay. Of course, I won't be when I get off, but... Oh, you know, if I lift my arms, they don't go straight up. They go out to the right. That's...
The faster you move your arms up and down, the more you're going to feel like...
Oh, yeah. I move them up and down fast. Boy, it's very strange. It's as if they're not jointed correctly. Now, that's the Coriolis force. You hear about it a lot in physics class, but never really experienced it like this. And now we're really spinning fast. How fast are we going now, Jaime?
We're going at 14 RPM.
14 RPM. So this is like simulated gravity on, you know, how many Gs would this be on my feet?
Probably be around 0.6 or something.
0.6 G, but that's kind of like what you'd get on Mars, right, for my feet. So it's only my feet that are getting the stretch. My head is just, you know, watching the world turn around here.
Do you feel any motion sickness?
No. Boy, this is really odd when you move your arms and they don't go where you want them to go. And that just shows that there really are forces at work here that I don't know about. If I were aboard ship here, if we turned off our artificial gravity on board this ship, you know, how many minutes or hours a day would I have to be in this thing in order to maintain my gravitational health?
Well, that's a good question.
Do you have any idea? I mean, is it on the order of minutes or hours?
It would be certainly less than what they do now. Right now, they spend about 3 hours a day
less than 3 hours a day in this thing,
yeah,
man.
Maybe an hour a day.
An hour a day? You better put a flat screen TV on this thing above my head.
So I can stop the centrifuge unless there's anything else you want to do?
No, that's, you can decelerate me, I guess. Wow. I feel like I'm getting squished.
Do you feel like you're going the other way now?
Yeah, I feel like I've been pushed in from the bottom. Well, I don't feel too bad. And, you know, normally on anything that spins around, like at the carnival, I get violently ill within about a minute, but this doesn't seem too bad. I don't know if I can do it for an hour every day. That might work, but who knows?
All right, well, you unbuckled it. Seatbelt there, lap belt, whatever kind. Now, all I have to do is somehow, without looking too awkward, just get out of this sled. Boy, you know, it makes you wonder how Santa Claus does that a couple of billion times a night. Ah, well, back on the floor here, and the world isn't spinning again. It's kind of nice, actually. That felt good, I gotta say. It was better than I expected. So you're doing this not for people who are going to another planet. Once they're down on the planet, there's gravity there working for them. But, you know, it's for the en route. It's for the trip. It's for the time they're in this weightless spacecraft, right?
Yeah, it's primarily for the long journey where you're in weightlessness unless you're able to get some exercise in our artificial gravity centrifuge. When you're on the planet, it's possible that the planet's own gravitational field is enough of a stimulus to keep you in good shape. Although that remains to be seen because we don't really know, as we've never been on the moon or Mars for a long period of time, so that remains to be seen.
Well, Jaime, I want to thank you very much for taking me for a spin here. It's been enjoyable, despite my worries.
Well, thank you for volunteering.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Jaime Mateus works at the Manned Vehicle Lab in the MIT Aeronautics and Astronautics Department. So, Seth, are your fears of spinning conquered?
I don't know, but Molly, that felt okay. Maybe if he had spun it faster, I wouldn't have felt okay.
So maybe you could be an astronaut after all.
Well, going to the moon is one thing, but how about that real trip to the outer solar system? I mean, I assume you saw Stanley Kubrick's movie 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Of course, it's a classic. These guys are in a big spaceship and they're headed for Jupiter. Now that's a case of bodies in long distance motion.
Right, and to make them comfortable, the living quarters were a giant centrifuge, rotating quickly enough that it mimicked the gravity of Earth.
Yeah, and I remember Kiera Dulles, it was Dr. Dave Bowman, and then there was the other guy.
Frank Poole, played by Gary Lockwood.
Right, and they're the only two crew members awake, and they get sabotaged by Hal, the onboard computer.
I know I've made some very poor decisions recently, but I can give you my complete assurance that my work will be back to normal.
Evil robot that he was. Anyway, the movie ends with that strange sequence in which a fetus appears floating in space and everyone is scratching their head trying to figure out what it all means.
Maybe we can get answers straight from the source. I actually spoke to both Kiera Dulles and Gary Lockwood recently at the Space Fest down in San Diego.
So they're back from Jupiter.
All right, I'm talking with Kiera Dulles and Gary Lockwood from 2001, and they're here at the Space Fest convention. I guess you get I'm sorry, Dave, quite a bit, Kiera. You are actually taking people to Jupiter. Do you have any interest in going to Jupiter?
Well, I've, you know, been there, done that. No, I'm kidding.
That's a good answer.
Yeah, you know, I was the first one there, so, you know, it's...
That's not true, Frank. What happened was when Hal blasted me off, I went flying by. I got there just before you did, actually. I mean, I never did tell you that until today.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, by then, I was unconscious. I didn't know I had gone by.
The only nice thing about having been in 2001 is that a few of the astronauts, or one in particular that I know, actually told us that it was having seen 2001 that resulted in him being, I'm serious, being an astronaut.
Listen, to what extent did this film, obviously it colored the careers, if you will, of a lot of people. I know a lot of people went into science because of this film by Kubrick. What about you guys? I mean, how did it affect your careers?
It was fine for us. I mean, I ended up getting several movies after just because I was in this. So, I mean, how could it hurt to be in maybe the best sci-fi movie, probably the best sci-fi movie ever made?
I mean, here we are 41 years later after the original release, which was 1968. And we do three or four of these kinds of events a year, and people keep asking us back. And the most exciting thing of all is the fact that young people in their early 20s, even earlier, who weren't even born when 2001, come by and ask for our autographs. They know this film, they've seen it, and it kind of is a hell of a tribute to Stanley Kubrick's genius that he created this film that is still considered the science fiction film of all time. And to have been a part of that is a real honor.
I have one regret, actually. I must tell you what it is. Nobody has ever really asked me about this, that I lost the chess match to Hal. I have, over the years, stayed a little angry about that.
What was it like working with Kubrick? Was he an easy director to work for or not?
The best. I say this so often, it's become a cliche for me, but it doesn't get better.
Yeah, absolutely.
It does not get better.
Stanley was a very anal type, you know. I mean, he was a detail man, but there's nothing wrong with that. I'm a bit of an architect type, so I thought it was great.
Yeah. You knew that you were in the presence of genius. There's no question about it. I mean, I was a huge Kubrick fan already by that time because he was a world-class director. He had done Spartacus, Doctor Strangelove, Lolita, perhaps the greatest anti-war film ever made, The Paths of Glory with Kirk Douglas. I mean, he was a man to contend with already by that time.
Kara, was there a particular line in that film that sticks in your mind after all these years?
Well, it sticks in my mind because it was gobbledygook at the time, and therefore I memorized it like a foreign language. It went something like this. Mission Control, this is X-ray Delta 1. At 1920 onboard fault prediction center, and our 9000 computer showed Alpha Echo 3-5 unit as possible failure within 48 hours. Request check your in-ship systems simulator. Also confirm your approval our plan to go EVA and replace Alpha Echo 3-5 unit prior to failure. Mission Control, this is X-ray Delta 1. Transmission concluded.
Now that's a line to remember.
That's absolutely a line to remember.
One final question, gentlemen. Do you understand what it all meant there at the end of that film?
I'm asked that constantly. And, it was never made to be fact. It's science fiction ruse. I mean, it's a movie. But so many people read so many things into it. And when one of the premieres, I think, in Hollywood, some nun ran up to us and said, it's the most godlike thing I've ever seen.
Like all great art, you can go in front of a famous Picasso painting, and depending on the individual staring at that painting, you're going to get a different interpretation. Now, Picasso isn't around anymore to answer the question, what does it mean? You know what? It kind of doesn't matter, because great art is so filled with metaphor, and each person brings their own metaphor to the experience, and I think that's really particularly true of 2001.
Kara Dullier, Gary Lockwood, thanks.
Yeah. A pleasure.
Thank you.
Kara Dullier and Gary Lockwood starred in Stanley Kubrick's 1968 film, 2001, A Space Odyssey.
Coming up, a spacecraft fails to follow a flight plan, plus our runaway universe. It's bodies in motion in this, the International Year of Astronomy. Find out how to get involved in the IYA at our website, radio.seti.org.
Hey, becoming a Team SETI member can keep you from going around in circles.
Your help supports the work of scientists at the SETI Institute.
And it's easy to do at SETI.org when you do sign up to be a Team SETI member.
Send us an email at the radio show, arewealone@SETI.org.
And we'll send you a glossy photo of the staff, this one without the poor fluorescent lighting.
Perfect for scraping dead bugs from the inside of your centrifuge.
Or working out Kepler's laws of motion on the back.
Your support helps keep us around and around and around.
SETI.org and Are We Alone at SETI.org. Keep yourself centered on science.
Yeah, and how do you stop this thing, Molly? Can someone find an off switch for this, please?
Welcome back to Are We Alone? Sometimes we learn something interesting about the universe because of a tiny little effect that, at first glance, looks just like a small measurement error.
For example, something called the precession of the perihelion of Mercury.
Right, that's what I was thinking.
Well, Mercury's orbit was changing by a tiny little amount, but in a way that didn't agree with what Isaac Newton had said about the laws of gravity. I mean, it was really just a tiny error, amounting to seeing Mercury off by the width of a human hair held at arm's length once every 100 years.
And let me guess, it was all because of relativity, right?
Yep, that's right. If you use relativity rather than Newton's laws to predict the motions of planets, then that small discrepancy goes away. Because according to relativity, the sun's mass warped space a little bit, just enough to account for this slight change in behavior.
But now, the theory of relativity itself might be challenged. Just as the planet Mercury had an unexplained perturbation of its motion, it seems that some of our spacecraft are not following the script either. The Pioneer spacecraft, launched in the 1970s, having completed their mission to photograph the bodies of the outer solar system, are now about 7 billion miles from Earth. But there's something puzzling going on, because like your car keys, the Pioneers are not where we expect them to be. And this may have implications for the laws of motion, says Mark Frank, a scientist specializing in the computation of orbits.
Mark, the Pioneer anomaly. What the heck is it?
There are two Pioneer spacecraft that are trying to exit the solar system, and we keep track of where they are, modeling all of the forces that are acting on them and receiving transmissions from them. However, they appear to be leaving the solar system slower than we're expecting them to.
Okay, so these spacecraft are simply not where they are expected to be. How far off are they? I mean, are they, you know, substantially behind in their trip here?
Well, about each year, they lose about 400 kilometers.
Okay, so over the course of, what has it been, a couple of decades now, you're talking about a substantial a difference.
Oh, yes, yes. And, you know, they've measured the error in acceleration, and, you know, that's at about the billionth of a meter per second level.
Well, that doesn't sound like such a lot. I've read somewhere that the difference, the accumulated difference in where we expected them to be and where they are is about a quarter of a million miles. So that's like the distance between the Earth and the Moon. But on the other hand, they've covered, what, 7 billion miles? I mean, they're way out there. They're, you know, it's more than 6 billion miles away, right?
Yes, it's a very small effect, very small acceleration. And over time, though, of course, it does build up. But it is a very small effect, and that's why it's unexpected. If it was a large effect, then there would have been a major error in the way they were modeling these things. And it's very subtle.
Okay, very subtle. If I reckon it right here, that's about one part in 30,000 or something like that. So that's sort of like your jet airliner, instead of being at 30,000 feet, it's at 29,999. Doesn't sound like a big deal. Why is it so important then?
Well, just by the fact that there's something going on that we don't understand, that makes it important.
So this is not just measurement error?
We're not sure. It could be measurement error. Or there could be a force that's acting of which we are unaware, or it could be some new type of physics that we haven't discovered yet. And that's what the scientists are examining.
Okay, well, you say that. Now, I'm thinking this spacecraft, it's headed for the outer solar system. It's going slower than we expected. Something's pulling it back. My first thought is, well, have they bothered to compute the gravitational pull of, you know, all these bodies in the outer solar system? There are a lot of rocks out there, after all. I mean, is that all worked in here?
Yeah, they've done a very thorough analysis as far as they can do. They've taken into account every gravitational body that they can think of. They're reexamining all of the observation data and reprocessing that, because they did find some anomalies in the early processing of the observation data. So they've gone back and they've corrected that. And they're looking at even how the heat is being transmitted off of the back of the spacecraft, and they're remodeling the thermal characteristics of the spacecraft to see if there's any small unmodeled force from the heat.
Well, how would that work? How would the heat slow down the spacecraft?
Well, energy or heat or light is the same thing as mass hitting something. You have a momentum effect, just like a billiard ball hitting another billiard ball. Well, if you hit the billiard ball with a flashlight, the effect will be really, really small, but there is some force, some momentum transfer that occurs there.
Okay, so heat is one possibility. I assume that doesn't account for the difference in where these things were expected to be and where they are, though. Otherwise, we would have solved the problem.
Well, they said that an error in their modeling of the heat of as little as 65 watts would account for that acceleration. And so that's why they've gone back and remodeled that. Now, keep in mind that these are nuclear electrical generators, and it's putting out a lot of waste heat in the kilowatt range.
What about sort of interstellar material? People think of space as being completely empty, perfect vacuum and all that, but it's not a perfect vacuum.
Right.
I've tried it on my living room. It's not a perfect vacuum. So couldn't it just be, you know, crud between the stars that's slowing this thing down?
Yeah, they're looking at that also, at the dust, thinking that possibly some additional drag is holding the spacecraft back due to the dust between the planets. But as far as they can tell, the dust that's there would not account for this.
Okay. Now, we're talking about the Pioneer 10 spacecraft as if it were one spacecraft. But in fact, there's Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11. They're kind of twins. Do they both suffer this effect?
Yes, both do.
Oh, my goodness. All right. So what are some of the other possible explanations that have been considered?
They were worried that maybe some helium from the generators might be leaking and causing some propulsion, some unmodeled propulsion.
So just a little gas jet leak, but it's acting like a little rocket.
Again, this is just a billionth of a meter per second squared acceleration, which is 1/10 billionth of gravity at the surface of the Earth. So it's a very tiny force.
Okay.
It wouldn't take much gas to accomplish that.
That's good. It sounds like it's more economical than my car. But Mark, what do you think about the big kahuna, as it were, the explanation that doesn't rely on, you know, well, there's something about the engineering of the spacecraft or the performance of the spacecraft or maybe a little bit of interstellar material, this, that, and the other, that this is telling us something very important, that there's physics that we don't know, that Newton was slightly wrong and it hasn't been corrected by Einstein. What about that possible explanation?
Some have proposed that precisely, that there was some new physics involved here that nobody knows about, having to do with general relativistic effects that they may not know about, some clock accelerations, a modification in the law of gravity.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of fancy verbiage in there and all sorts of physics that, you know, I don't understand. But any of these looking promising, or are physicists simply throwing their hands up and saying, we just don't know yet?
They're first going to completely examine the conventional effects before they start going to these.
To the esoteric, we need new physics kind of things.
Yeah, and that seems like the right thing to do.
Well, finally, Mark, if I were trying to understand this, I think one thing I would do is look at other spacecraft that are traversing very long distances going to the outer solar system, the Voyagers, maybe this New Horizons mission on its way to Pluto. Is that being done? Is that a reasonable thing to do to see if they suffer this same problem?
You make a very good point, Seth. And yeah, they've gone back and tried to look at older spacecraft. One of them, or some of them, though, do a lot of thrusting. And the uncertainty in the thrusters would mask this effect here, so they couldn't use those. The New Horizons, I believe, is one that they're going to try to use to measure this.
I find this kind of an interesting story because this is one of those small anomalies that crop up every now and again in astronomy where you think you understand something, but the measurement doesn't quite agree. And sometimes, maybe not often, that's a doorway opening to a whole new physics.
You know, that's the exciting thing about science and physics is we get to learn something new when we find something unexpected. So that's what's fun.
Well, thank you very much, Mark, for talking with me.
You're welcome. Thank you, Seth.
Mark Frank is an astrodynamicist in California. Well, Seth, that's a story about the motion of spacecraft. But when we talk about motion, there's the biggest motion of them all, the expansion of the universe.
I'll second that motion. No, you're right, Molly. The discovery that the universe is not just expanding, but accelerating, was probably the biggest scientific discovery of the last dozen years. Astronomer Robert Kirshner was one of the researchers who made this remarkable discovery.
Yeah, well, we've known that the universe is expanding for a long time. That's since 1929 or so. People have been pretty sure that that's really right. But what we've found in the last 10 or 12 years is that the expansion has been speeding up over time. And that's a real surprise because everybody thought gravity would make it slow down.
Now, how did we find that out?
Well, you have to measure the distances to things and their velocities. That's the basic thing, how we measure the expansion. That's what Hubble did back in the 1920s. So you need something whose distance you can measure and whose speed you can measure. The distance we measure by looking at a certain kind of exploding star, type 1a supernovae. These are exploding stars that are about as bright as 4 billion stars like the sun. So they're really bright. We can see them over a long distance. And by judging how bright they appear, we can figure out how far away they are. So that's the distance part. The speed part comes from taking the light from the supernova or the galaxy that it's in and spreading it out into a spectrum. And we can measure from that how fast the galaxy is moving away from us. And what we find is, then we look at the relation between velocity and distance. It's not exactly the thing that Hubble found 70 years ago, but that the expansion has actually been speeding up over time, that the distances are a little bigger than you would expect for the velocities because things have been going faster and the light takes longer to get to you.
Now, is this a small effect? I mean, has it been, are we accelerating by, half a percent, a hundredth of a percent, or is this a big effect?
Well, it's a little effect now, but if it is due to something that doesn't change over time, it'll get bigger and bigger. It's literally exponential. That means the amount of speeding up will depend on how big the universe is. So the bigger it gets, the faster it goes. And what we see is that it's really only, the universe we think is about 14 billion years old. It's for the last 5 billion years, more or less, that this acceleration has been detectable. So it's only kind of recently. It's really just gotten started. We don't know precisely what the properties are of this dark energy. We call it the stuff that makes the universe speed up. But if it's constant, which is the simplest guess, then things are going to speed up faster and faster over time, and the universe will thin out really fast.
Could it lead to a kind of a super-duper explosion, a big rip? This has been proposed that this is one of the scenarios for something that could befall us.
Yes. The idea is that if the energy of this dark energy actually increases as the universe gets bigger, then it'll go faster than exponential. That's what people are talking about, is this big rip, in which case not only will the galaxies move farther and farther apart from one another, so we'll see fewer of them as time goes by, and things will get dark and cold and lonely, but it's even possible, or anyway not ruled out, that maybe the actual things in the universe, the stars, would rip apart, and even the atoms could rip apart, and so on. Now, you shouldn't worry too much or have to check your homeowners or insurance or anything. I mean, we don't know whether that's going to happen or not. But it's very important to us, and I think it's interesting to everybody, to kind of know what's running the universe. And it seems like there's this kind of hidden battle between gravity from dark matter and this expansive stuff from the dark energy. And there's a kind of tug of war that's been going on, and it looks like the dark energy's winning, and there's no end to it in sight. So what we want to do is measure more precisely exactly how this has happened, because we can see into the past. We can see the light that's been coming to us from the past. We can't see into the future, but if we understood what the dark energy was, we could predict the future, and that would be really interesting.
Well, let me just return to that big rip scenario just briefly. If it were to take place, right, I assume you're still smiling. You don't seem to be selling your properties, so you're not worried about it within a lifetime. What is the time scale for the big rip?
Well, I guess it would be many times the current age of the universe before this would really get going. So, as I say, we're much better at observing the past than we are at observing the future. But even so, we want to understand what the rules of the game are. What are the laws of physics? What is the universe made of? And these dark things, this dark matter and this dark energy, together seem to be 96% of the universe, which is very interesting, that the stuff you see is indicating what's going on, but it's not the stuff itself. It's like looking at a truck at night. The headlights are bright, but most of the mass in the truck is not in the headlights. It's in, it's in the body of the truck. And so it's the stuff that you don't see seems to be the most important in determining how the universe is going to change over time.
We seem to be in the headlights, as it were, ourselves when it comes to this dark energy that's pushing the universe apart at an accelerating pace. Do you think that the kind of experiments that you're envisioning for the near future, in which you can measure this effect more accurately, will that give us any clue as to what dark energy is?
Yes, I think so. And so what we have to do is make the measurements better than we've done so far. We've worked really hard using big telescopes in Chile and in Hawaii and in Arizona, all around the world, measuring these exploding stars and getting hundreds of them and measuring them quite precisely. But we need to make the measurements better. We need to watch out for tricky things like the way dust absorbs the light from supernovae. It could make them appear to be farther away, but they weren't really. So we have to avoid all those traps and tricks and make sure that we get this measurement done really well. We're talking about building a satellite that could be launched maybe in 10 years or so, and that would make fantastic measurements of the dark energy. And I think that might be well worth the effort, because this is a big deal. This is most of the universe, and we want to know what it is.
Finally, Bob, this is a big deal. I mean, this is arguably the most important discovery in science in the last dozen years. And you were one of the guys who did this. Did you see this coming? If somebody had told you 15, 20 years ago, this research program you're embarking upon might lead to something like this.
No, not at all. I think, the supernovae are very interesting objects. They're how nature ends the life of a star. They make heavy elements out of light ones. They're really interesting and fun things, and I was studying them for those reasons. But this idea that you might possibly be able to tell whether the universe was speeding up or slowing down was not on my mind. There were people working on it when I was a beginning graduate student, but they were using galaxies, which are quite a lot brighter, to try to measure these distances. And I thought, you know, that might succeed, although it would be done by somebody else. The fact that the supernovae turned out to be the path is really just good luck.
Bob Kirshner, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Seth.
Robert Kirshner is an astronomer at Harvard University, and that's it for our show. Hey, Seth, do you think you can get the studio to move at warp speed like you did that car?
Well, sure. Let me just lower the casters and tighten this wing nut over here. I'll just push down on the thruster control.
Meanwhile, I'll do some thanks. Thanks to the bodies whose motion accelerates the production of the show, Barbara Vance and Gary Niederhoff.
Warp drive engines warming up. Also, thanks to the NASA Astrobiology Institute and the SETI Institute for their support. Ready, Molly? Buckled up?
Yep. This show has been one in a series in a celebration of the International Year of Astronomy. Find out more by going to our website, radio.seti.org.
Support for Are We Alone provided by Sun Microsystems, the creator of Java, who invites you to visit java.com and experience the power of Java in a wide array of consumer electronics.